Welcome to the 2023 Virtual Region Convention and to our keynote session. Tonight's keynote speaker is Larry. He will speak for 30 minutes and then we will have a Q&A session for 20 minutes. Larry, go ahead.
Thank you very much. I'm Larry. I'm a compulsive overeater. I'm very honored to have been asked to be the keynote speaker. I've been in OA for 37 years. February 11th of 1986 was when I first joined. But I have been abstinent for, as of May the 1st, approximately, it will be 30 years that I've been abstinent and have achieved the incredible miracle of neutrality from the food, which I'll be talking about a little bit later on. My 7 years of recovery and relapse and recovery and relapse have taught me a great deal about the mistakes that I made in this program for the first 7 years. And I hope to be able to share with you some real simple concepts that it took me a long time to understand. The more complex we think our mind is, the less able we're to understand the simplicity of the 12 steps. So I'm going to talk about the steps, and I'm going to talk about what we can learn from them. After all, Tradition 5 says that the only purpose of our fellowship is to carry the message of recovery through the 12 steps to those who still suffer. And that's why I'm here, and that's why everyone else is engaged in the activities they are to make this convention possible. There are people who suffer from an addiction that from our point of view is life or death, is as serious as any other addiction and deserves to be taken as seriously as any other addiction. And we want to help those who suffer from the same addiction that we have suffered. So the first thing I want to say about the steps is about them in general. The first is that they should be taken in order and all or nothing. They are not suggested individually. They are suggested as a program. You can take or leave the program, but the program is the 12 steps. We are a 12-step fellowship. The second thing that I have learned is that each step doesn't take the same amount of time to do as every other step. Some steps take longer, and some steps can be incredibly short. And it depends on who we are, what our situation is, and our understanding as to how long the steps might take us to work through. So I want to start by talking about step one, and then I'll go on to two and on to three and so on, and talk about the things that I have learned about the steps that have really changed my life and gave me the kind of recovery that I have enjoyed for such a long time. The first thing is that we have to be persuaded that this is life or death. We do not have, for most of us, for the vast, vast majority of us, we do not have a dramatic addiction. I'm not going to eat a donut and suddenly lose my mind and walk into dangerous traffic. Or for those of us who are under eaters, I'm not going to, or restrictors, or vomiters. We're not going to do one incident of one day of fasting or one moment of purging and suddenly do walk into traffic and have the possibility of dying or gamble away our life savings or anything of that sort. And there are some addictions which may not be serious addictions. I was addicted to coffee, needing 12 to 20 cups a day. That's a serious addiction, and I had to get rid of my drinking of caffeine. But there are many people in this world who need one or two cups of coffee or tea a day just to get up in the morning or to get started. That's not medically serious. It doesn't impair them. So although many of us who are compulsive eaters, overeaters, undereaters, might recognize that we have an addiction, we also have to be persuaded that it is a dangerous and deathly addiction before we start to take it seriously. In addition, it's important for us who suffer from what we consider to be a deathly addiction to convey to the rest of the world that it is as serious and has to be taken as seriously as other addictions. And it's important for us to understand that. For those of us who accept that it's the deadly addiction, we think of the long-term gradual deterioration of our ability to act, to think, to be in this world in the present. Whether we undereat or overeat, our bodies get to the point where they become less and less able to do things. I could go into detail, but I'm not going to, but for those of us who know this and have experienced even part of that, the isolation, the inability to be there, it has affected our lives, and we are doomed to a slow motion death, a death by a thousand cuts that is different from the drama of some of the other kinds of addiction. Not all of them, but from some of them. So it has to be seen as life or death. The second thing that I learned, and I learned this, it took me 7 years to learn, is that each one of us, and this is the group conscience of OA, has to figure out what it is we must abstain from. I have to abstain from some things that others in this very room don't have to abstain from, and other people have to abstain from things that I don't have to abstain from. My first sponsor, bless his heart, is a wonderful sponsor, and he told me that what I had to do was diet, reach a healthy body weight, and then work the steps, and the steps would allow me to eat moderately so that I wouldn't overeat and I wouldn't gain the weight again. That worked for him. That's how he got abstinent. He abstained from overeating, from binging. I discovered that there were some foods I had to abstain from, because once I started to eat those foods, I developed cravings in my body that wanted more and more of them. Unlike my sponsor, who only once he started to binge needed to binge more and more, I had certain foods and certain ingredients. I went through a whole process of analysis, which I won't go into right now, but I had to figure out those things. And the other thing about OA is that we are we have a spectrum of addictions, not all of which, most of which are not shared by others. You know, there are behavior addictions like gambling, codependency, shopaholic, all those. There are single substance fellowships like Alcoholics Anonymous, Cocaine Anonymous, Crystal Meth Anonymous, Nicotine Anonymous. There are combinations of ingredients, Narcotics Anonymous, for instance, that aren't just one substance. We have people who might have only behavior compulsive eating addictions, and people who might only have a single substance addictions. And many of us, like me, have a combination of behaviors and single substances, a whole bunch of single substances, and combinations of ingredients. For me, my biggest addiction is to high fat content mixed with either sugar or with salt. That's me. But there are other people I know who do not have that addiction. And other people can't eat a certain kind of food, and I can. So we have to be individual, and that's the other significant thing. We have to do our own analysis, and that is the group conscience of OA. And it distinguishes us from other food-related fellowships, which might have one particular plan of eating, because they've all agreed on the things that they have to abstain from. The third thing about step one that took me a while to understand was that my problem was not that I got cravings when I indulged in certain behaviors or when I indulged in certain foods. It was that I couldn't stay abstinent from those, that I didn't have just a problem with once I started, I couldn't stop. I had the real problem was I couldn't stop from starting. I had any number of reasons that I could give myself to go back to that which I knew ultimately caused me problems, caused my addiction to start again. And these reasons can range from deeply traumatic memories of horrible suffering as a child to silly things like, well, they made it especially for me. And in between are things like, I'd like to celebrate, or everyone else is having some, why can't I? Or it's inexpensive, or it's free, or it's so easy to do, no one will know that I did it. Or I've been good for a long time, which could be as long as 5 minutes, I haven't done this for 5 minutes or for an hour or for a year, and so I can do it now. Whatever it is, what I have been persuaded, and you'll find this in the big book, and you'll also find it in the pamphlet, A New Plan of Eating, and also in the first few pages on step one in the 08, 12, and 12. I have a mind that finds a reason that somehow makes sense at the time to go back to that which I know I should have stayed from. So my problem is ultimately, I cannot stop once I've started, and I can't stop from starting again. This vicious circle is the real problem. And so the problem, as the big book says, is in my mind, not my body. If I knew I couldn't eat shrimp or peanuts, because if I did so, I would get the anaphylactic shock that might choke me, I sanely would not eat shrimp and peanuts. But even though I know that for me, ice cream is something that I have devoured, you know, big jar of gallons of, somehow I didn't have the sanity to say, well, I won't have it this time. I kept saying to myself, and in this I was aided and abetted by any number of diets that I was on, you can have a little bit, just a little bit won't hurt you. And of course it did. So the real problem then is that my mind keeps finding reasons. That's step one, to find a plan of eating, to accept this issue, and to realize that on your own, you can never fix the mind problem because your mind thinks faster than you do. It's always there in the background, and it finds the reason. It clicks it in, and it may be deep, and it may be stupid or insane. But it finds a reason to say, oh, okay, I'll have some, or I'll do this. If that is the reality of my addiction, then the solution must come from outside of myself, because I can't do it myself. And I am faced with the reality that millions and millions of addicts, including compulsive eaters, with dozens and dozens of addictions, have used the 12 steps to change their mind, to have their minds changed, to gain the power of sanity. And the sanity is as simple as, why would I eat this? It's poison for me. Or why would I indulge in this behavior? It will hurt me. I know that the addiction will ultimately kill me. Therefore, I shouldn't start. I've had that miracle for almost 30 years. It makes me tear up sometimes to realize how amazing it is. It means absolutely nothing to my non-compulsive overeater or under-eater friends. Well, I mean nothing to my friends who are not compulsive eaters. It means everything to the compulsive eater I meet in the rooms of OA. To be able to be around or to be have available the things that used to tempt me and no longer want them. That's what we promise in OA, and we don't always talk about it as much as we should. We talk about spiritual, emotional, and physical recovery. But we don't talk about this freedom of being able to be around the things or be in a position to indulge in what we know we have to abstain from, and not say, I don't want to do it, I have to do it, I don't want to do it, but to say, why would I do it? Other people can enjoy it, but I can't. And that's the true miracle. Now, what I learned in step two, and I learned this especially significantly for me, because I have no belief in any deity or any god or any creative energy of any kind. And I was going to meetings where people said that, you know, they were late for the meeting, and but God, they prayed and God found them a parking spot. And I was like, God doesn't do that, you know, and it was difficult. What I learned was so simple. And that is that we all believe in something. Some of us, we have deep essential beings, values, beliefs that we cannot justify in any logical way. They are just part of us. Some of us attribute that, well, probably most of us in the rooms in a way, attribute that to some kind of deity or creative spirit. And others like me attribute it to deep beliefs that are the essence of who we want to be and who we think we are. But either way, they're deep beliefs. And the image in the big book that has really stuck with me is that our problem is not that we don't believe in something. It is that we are blocked off from what we believe in when we live in our addiction. And to be blocked off is very different from not believing. It means we aren't able to live in harmony with that which we believe in. When I, you know, if you imagine a compass of 360 degrees, and if there's a true north of some kind, when I'm in my addiction, I'm going 180 degrees. I'm going backwards. The best I can do, because I'm human, is working the steps. I go 3 or 4 degrees one way or the other. So I sort of go slowly towards the true north of my deepest values. Some people believe they're pushed by their gods, by their scriptures, or by people who interpret the scriptures. Other people, like me, feel pulled by my values. I'm pulled to the true north as long as I work the 12 steps. So the blockage is removed. Whether I believe deeply in a deity of some kind who has somehow rejected me or is somehow not listening to my prayers, the problem is not that that deity is listening. It's that you can't hear. And that blockage is the problem. What we want to do is get rid of the blockage, so what's deep in our hearts, our deepest beliefs, wells through the pipeline up to our heads where we think and act, so that we think and act in harmony with what we believe. Now, when we think and act in harmony with what we believe, we're sane. And when we're sane, we look at the things that used to beckon to us and say, why would I indulge in these things? And that's as simple as this program is. So we strive for the spiritual awakening, which indicates that we have unblocked the pipeline between what we deeply believe and how we think and act. And we do that through steps 4 through 9. And this is the other, and so to talk about step 3, because I've already talked about step 1 and 2, step 3, in essence, is a decision to go on with the rest of the steps. I've heard a wonderful speaker say that the proof that you have taken step 3 is that you have started on step 4. I can make a decision to be the speaker at this thing, but if I don't click the right things and put in the right password, I'm not going to be here. And so any decision that's not accompanied by action is fruitless and pointless. Some of us wait and wait for promises to come to us at step 3, but there are no promises really that are going to happen if we say, well, I'm ready to turn my will and my life over, but we don't do anything to turn our will and our life over. The steps are the instructions on how to turn our life over. The other thing that's important from step 3, and this is it from a big book perspective, is that our ultimate problem that we want to play, we want to be in charge of the past, the present, and the future. From one point of view, we want to play God. We know what life should have been, and it hasn't been right. It hasn't gone right. And some of us, not me, but so many of us in a way, again, I say not me with the greatest of deference and humility, because I know so many people who have suffered. Many of us in a way have suffered horribly as children, traumatically, terribly. And those are people who justly and properly wish that the past had not occurred the way it did. They deserved a good childhood. They deserved a loving childhood. They deserved a childhood free of trauma and abuse. And some people in OA did not have that. And they have every right to want that and to have wanted it. But to live in that world in which the past did not exist, or the if only, or the would have, could have, should have life, is to live in a completely unreal world, and where you want to change what is impossible to change, which is the past. Some of us want to change the future or want to be in charge of the future. We worry so much about the outcomes that we don't live in the present and know how to act in the present. We want to control the outcomes, and that creates anxieties or fears or frustrations because things don't go our way. And so this need to be in charge of the world, the past, the present, the future, is what is ultimately blocking us off from what we deeply believe in. Because if we have deep beliefs, we should live according to those beliefs, and whatever consequences might arise, or whatever might have happened to us in the past, is much less relevant, if not irrelevant, to who we are and how we can define ourselves today. And then steps fourth, and step three is a short step. You understand it, and you say whatever step three prayer you want to say, and you go immediately on to step four. And step four, five, six, seven, eight, and nine are a package. It is designed to identify the defects of character which are blocking us from our deepest values, and to get rid of them promptly and without regret, as the big book says. And there are many ways of doing step four and many ways of doing step five. And I have my own way of doing it, but my experience is that it doesn't matter how you do it, as long as you do it while abstaining from that which you know you should be abstaining from, so your mind is clear and your body is clear, and you do it as honestly as you can. And there's a lot to be said about it, and too much, and I won't say that much about it. But I want to say one other thing, and that is that right after we do step five, we can be doing six and seven and eight within a day. Because step six simply asks, do you want to have your defects of character removed? And the answer, if you have done it honestly with another, shared it with another human being, is going to be, well, yeah, that's what's blocking me from recovery. And then what is step seven? Step seven is simply a prayer. Please take away my defects of character. You don't wait at step seven for your defects to be removed. In steps eight and nine, you are making the amends that change who you are, that unblock the passageway, because you are in effect reinventing yourself or recreating yourself as a person who is doing their best to live according to what they believe in. And that means, if you've done something wrong, you want to make up for it. It means that you want to live better with your fellow human beings that you're in frequent contact with, your family, your co-workers, your good friends. And in effect, you are saying, I used to be a person who was living according to their addiction, who was blocked off from what they truly believed in. And I don't want to be like that anymore. I have to clean the past as much as I can in order to live properly in the present, to live a life dedicated to what I deeply believe in. Now, many of us in OA, and again, I am not one of those, have suffered badly at the hands of other people. And the amends we owe might never be to those people who harmed us, other than if you come to the conclusion that they are harming themselves, as some do, that they are harming themselves by having done what they did. They're harming their souls or their inner being. They're becoming the worst kind of human being possible. if some people who would say that would say that my job is now to help them stop doing it by going to the police, for instance, or by denouncing them or by in some way helping to stop them. So the amends can be very tricky and can be very, very subtle. And we have to think not only, and we have to separate 8 and 9. 8 is we become willing to make the amends, but 9 is we're not going to make them if to do so would injure other people more than it would help them. And that distinction is really interesting because and wonderful because when we get to step 9, if we don't make the amends, it's not because we're afraid of making them. It's because we aren't doing them because it would cause more harm than good. Very different perspective for the same action. Last but not least then with my 5 minutes is 10, 11, and 12. What I learned is that 10 is different from 11. The evening meditation in step 11 focuses on the day. How did I do today and how much better can I do tomorrow? It allows us to live in the present once we have these promises of the spiritual awakening that are guaranteed by the end of step 9, this neutrality around food. Step 10 is, what's going on in my whole life? What is bothering me? Are some of my defects coming back because of the new occurrences of things that are going on? Am I not hearing the noise of the factory because I'm in it so long, but if I step back, there are bad things going on in the world, there are bad things that I'm worried about, there are all these things. It's time to do another cleaning, another house cleaning. And that's one thing I discovered about step 10 is to distinguish between step 10 as a complete house cleaning that has to be done every so often, maybe once a night, maybe once a week, maybe once a year. But every so often, we have to clean our house in the way we did in steps 4 through 9. That's different from the daily meditations that keep us connected day to day to our higher power. And the last, and that's what step 11 is related to. And the last thing is step 12. And when you shut me up, I'll just stop talking because I could talk for hours about step 12. We have not a duty. If we don't carry the message to those who still suffer, we're going to die. Our addiction will come back. 11/12 measures avail us nothing. There is no way that without giving away what we have been given, we can keep what we have. And if we don't understand that it's our duty, our responsibility, our great need to carry the message, then we miss what our job as sponsors are and our job going to meetings are. I go to meetings to carry the message. I receive the message, and now it's my job to carry it. I don't need what they give me. I need to give to the meetings. And I have a responsibility to make my message as clear as possible and to make sure that the people who come hear the right kind of message. I have a duty to make sure that the meetings I go to are there to carry the message of recovery to the 12 steps to those who still suffer, not just, oh, it's such a nice program and we give you lots of support, anything like that. That's irrelevant. We do give support. But Tradition 5 says we give support to people who want to work the fellowship, who want to work the 12 steps. We are not a support group, a therapy group, an advice group, an advocacy group of any kind. We are a Tradition 5 is clear. Our job as OA and our job as individual members of OA who have recovered is to carry the message of recovery to the 12 steps to those who still suffer. In doing so, we might give support. In doing so, we might give some advice, but it better be suggestions and not orders, because we're not in charge of anyone, including people we sponsor. Our job then becomes fulfilling. The most wonderful thing I have seen in this program, the miraculous thing, is not just the miracle that's occurred to me, but the miracle I've seen happen to people who have been terribly, terribly hurt. And have suffered terribly, both as children and as adults, who are able to say to those who still suffer, yes, I hear how bad things are for you. These are how bad things were for me. And I don't eat over them. And I don't worry about them anymore. I have dealt with them. And that kind of, the Big Book promises our darkest past is our deepest possession, is our most precious possession. It is. I can't tell people who have suffered badly in the past or even suffering badly now, oh, you know, don't worry about it because I haven't suffered. And so the beautiful miracle of this program is that the worst things that have ever happened to us can be transformed into something that can help the person who still suffers. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Laurie. We will now open the floor for a question and answer session. So we'll start with the first one. I struggle with the wording of some of the steps. Example, defects of character, the exact nature of our wrong, our shortcoming. These words make me feel bad about myself. How do you deal with these words that seem so negative?
That's a great question. First of all, it is clear from the big book, which contained the first 12 steps, you know, the first version of the 12 steps. And Bill, it confirmed by evidently there's a letter that Bill Wilson wrote explaining this, that defects of characters, wrongs, and shortcomings all mean the same thing. And they are, they're not to be interpreted as being different. And you'll see that in the big book where the word defects of character are used in the two steps in which they're not found in the body of the big book. But think of them as the things that are blocking us from what we deeply believe in. As a defect of character, you can think of it as sort of like a structural defect, something that's keeping you from building the kind of person you want to be. And, you know, there's nothing, there's no guilt in this fellowship. That's one of the most important things we have to learn is that, you know, the need to have the past not to have occurred, if you've been traumatically treated as a child, is the defect of character only from the sense that it is blocking you from living a life in the present. And it is absolutely understandable. It's predictable. It's so tragic that someone suffered these horrible things. And the wish to change the past is understandable. It's just impossible. And part of what we go through as we work through the defects of characters, we get a sense that even though everything's understandable, there's no guilt to have suffered from them, they are preventing us from building the structure that we need to build to become whole human beings. And there's nothing wrong with trying to become a better human being. So that's, I guess, the way we would do it. But the big book has this image of the arch through which we pass to a better world. Well, think of the defects of character as structural problems. The bricks aren't that good. Well, you know, you've got to shore up the bricks. You've got to put more mortar. You've got to become a different person so that the arch is complete. So a defect like that isn't a blameworthy defect. It's not something that should make you feel bad about yourself. It's something you learn to improve.
Thank you. The next one. Can you finish your thoughts on the ideas around making amends to someone who has committed a felony or misdemeanor that should be reported to authority? I know someone who is in that situation, and I am unsure what to tell them.
Well, I can certainly say this, that I think every situation is absolutely individual, and I would never give the same advice. I don't give advice. I ask people to look into their hearts and give them options and to see which option makes their heart feel better. You know, that's what I do. But at any rate, here's some examples that some of my friends have gone through. Very different. One of them went to the police and reported a person for sexual abuse. Another announced at a family gathering, this uncle did this, this, and this, and don't let him near your children. A third said nothing. The guy's 95. He's dying alone. No one loves him. He's suffered enough. And other people have said, no, the amends I owe are not to the people who harmed me. The amends I owe are to the people I have harmed as a result of my lack of ability to be intimate, my inability to hug, my rejection of friendships, my feelings of shame and guilt about something over which I had no control. So the amends I owe are to the people I could be friends with, the people I could love, the people who love me. So I don't think there's any, there's no one answer, but there is a balance to be looked at. Will it do more, you know, think of the example of a child about to run off a cliff. And the only way to save that child is to grab onto their arm and in doing so break the arm but save the child. So you are causing some pain, but the pain is necessary in order to avert a greater horrible tragedy. That's the kind of thing you can think about if you think it's worth it to think about reporting someone to the police. Stop them from causing pain to other people and to yourself and to themselves by going to the police. Might be one idea that someone might come to. The other hand, they might say, you know, if I, you know, do I go to my spouse and say I'm sorry, my abusive ex-spouse, and say I'm sorry I stayed in the relationship too long? I would say if they don't feel any remorse for what they did, there's no way that should be done, because that puts you in the position of being further abused, whether just physically, whether physically or in some other way. So in such a case, you know, it really helps to have someone else be a give you feedback, but never, never orders. I've met people say, why my sponsor is telling me I must apologize to so-and-so. I would say, I don't think there's, you know, I don't think there's any reality to that.
Thank you. There are a number of questions when you started to talk about the differences between step 10 and 11. And someone had said that, they thought it would continue to take personal inventory. And then when you had said sometimes that you do step 10 once a night, week, or month, can you clarify a little more about that?
Yes, I'd like to very much. Because I think there's a real problem at times. I suffered this problem. And I'll give this example. In my years of relapse, there was a time when I would yell at my children for spilling milk. They were young, and I would yell at them. I would get so frustrated. When I look back at what was really going on in my life is that there were some really hard things going on, especially with my wife's family, whom I loved dearly, who were dying. And I couldn't be angry at them, and I couldn't yell at the situation, so I would yell at my children. But when I thought that step 11 said when we were wrong, promptly admitted it, all I had to do was apologize to my children. I didn't have to reframe what was going on in my life. I didn't have to do what I have done in step 4 through 9, which was, you know, what's going on with my wife? Do I resent her because she's taking time away from our time to do what I absolutely agree she had to do to help take care of her sister, her mother, and her father? And I knew she had to do that, but I still resented that fact. You know, all those things that were going on in my mind. So for me, step 10 is stepping back, as it were, and looking at everything. And the inventory process that we embarked on in steps 4 through 9, the journey, is what step 10 is all about. We do exactly the same as we did in step 4 through 9, but we're recovered. We're using it for different purposes. We're using it to keep the channel open and to keep it from blocking up. But step 11, if you read it very carefully, well, if you read step 11 as it stands, and if you read step 11 in the big book, you will see that it's all devoted to how do I live during the day, and how do I get inspiration from the connection that I have? Step 10 keeps the connection open. Step 11 allows me to live with that connection and listen carefully to the welling up of my deepest values into my head. So for me, there's a big difference, and that has kept me from relapsing. It's not step 11 that keeps me from relapse. It's step 10. Every so often, sometimes it's once a week and sometimes it's once a year, depending on what's going on in my life, I use step 10 to center myself again. And I do it in writing, whereas I would say step 11 is done in your head, the daily meditations. And I think there's a big difference. And when I'm ready to do step 10, I will share it with another human being. I will do the meditation and I will work out what kind of amends I have to do. I hope that helps.
Thank you. About the identifying your accident and eating plan, can you talk more about how you came to know what your particular eating plan or how you can help someone else identify what their red light foods are?
Sure. First of all, Each person has to do it themselves, so I don't impose what I do on anyone else. I don't suggest that they look at it. But I look at both a comment. How I developed it was to look at the foods that I had overeaten and binged on in my life, and I saw the major ingredient was high fat mixed with sugar, or high, like desserts, and high fat mixed with salt, like buttered popcorn and, you know, skin, you know, deep fried chicken and things like that. And so I had to abstain from high fat and that. And I had a few foods that I obviously couldn't eat in addition to any food that was high fat with sugar and salt. I hadn't lost weight though, or I got abstinent, I worked the steps, I felt great, but I hadn't lost weight because my volume hadn't changed. And so I then realized the big, our OA 12 and 12 talks about eating behaviors, and our definition of abstinence talks about eating behaviors. So I looked at volume behaviors that I had, and my volume behaviors came down to two major behaviors that I realized after 5 or 6 months I had to abstain from. One of them was the need to keep chewing all the time. That was advised by the diet program I used to be on. And, you know, I used to chew gum constantly or chew celery or carrots. And what that did for me, but not for other people necessarily, is to create the need to eat more, even of foods that weren't addictive to me. So it just increased my volume. So I had to adopt 3 meals a day, nothing in between, a day at a time, in order to abstain from chewing or sucking between meals. It could be 4 meals a day, 5 meals, 6 meals, it doesn't matter, but I avoided that. The other one was this need that I've had since childhood to be filled beyond my gullet, you know, figuratively, you know, just to be stuffed. And that was mine as a child. I've had that ever since I was a kid. So I had to figure out a way simply to stop eating when I was reasonably full as opposed to being stuffed. And I've been able to find a way to do that without weighing and measuring, but many people I know feel the need to weigh and measure to make sure that either if they're under-eaters, they're getting enough, or if they're over-eaters, they're not getting too much. And so I understand weighing and measuring, and as I get older and my metabolism changes, I might have to do that as well. But so when I ask, when people work out their plan of eating, I ask them to look, I sort of cross-examine them, but I ask them to work with what were the foods that they know they've overeaten if they're overeaters, or what are the behaviors they've indulged in if they're undereaters, and to work with them as to whether there are any ingredients, as like common ingredients to the foods that they've overeaten, and also I ask them to look at their behaviors, and then we talk.
Thank you. The next one, do you have any suggestions to make step four the most meaningful? What was the most impactful way you worked that step, the fourth step?
Well, I am a big book thumper, and there is a way of working the big book steps that has, for me, been very powerful. And for me, it's the most impactful, and it seems to be impactful for a lot of people I have worked with or who have worked it this way. And that whole process is to start off with our resentments. Anything that bothers us, not that we're necessarily angry about, things we're frustrated about, things that are niggling at us in some way, and to work from our resentments to what our defects of character are, and there are only four of them, according to the big book. Self-will, our wish to be in charge. Dishonesty, but there's an understanding of what dishonesty is, that not just lying, cheating, or stealing. Sometimes it's being dishonest to ourselves about the reality of the situation. It's lying to ourselves and living in a world of would have, could have, should have. The third thing kind of dishonesty there is not telling the truth when the truth should be told, because we are people pleasers, but many of us are, and we don't want to rock the boat, and we want to be liked. And sometimes we have to stand up for what we believe in, or avoid people who believe the thing, who won't listen to what is right, or won't do the right thing. And that kind of dishonesty I have found for many of us, and for me certainly, was a major thing. And then when we deal with the fears and what is called the sex conduct or complex relationship parts of the rest of the step four, fears, and the other three of self-will, dishonesty, and self-seeking. I didn't talk about self-seeking. It's the wish to be liked, the wish to feel good about ourselves, using other people to do that. The big book's way ends up sending us beyond those defects into how we can live without those defects. We say a prayer. What would my higher power have to be in relation to this fear? What kind of a person can I envision who could deal with this fear? A person who accepts the reality of the situation, a person who is an adult and faces what is real and unreal. And then the big book says in relation to relationships and difficult and complex relationships, where did I go wrong in these? And what should I have done instead? In other words, how could I have lived without being self-will, with being honest, and without using other people as a means of defining who I am? And so I have found that to be very powerful, because by the end of that process, not only have you identified your defects of character, but you also have seen a way out and living in a world different from without those defects of character. And that's before you even get to step five. And then you can really... Okay.
So as a follow-up, what do you do if you have fear that's caused from PTSD? You have any advice on stopping the fear?
Well, I've met people who have that, and I certainly would not take away from the value of any other therapy that they could go to that might help them deal with it. I can't give any advice on that issue. I can only say that if one is living in a world in which there has been heavy, heavy trauma, and I've met people like that who have used the 12 steps alone to deal with that, or have been to therapy, who go to therapy and use the 12 steps. Ultimately, it comes down to accepting the reality of a situation and living in the present and not the past, and not trying to be in charge of the future. That's the simple answer. There's no real answer to that one question, because each person requires very personalized work on that. And again, it's what resonates with them, not what I think they should do. And some people go to therapy and they get so much out of it. Bill Wilson had a personal psychiatrist. You know, so there's nothing wrong. The big book says we should look to others. And there are many people who need therapy. They also need to work the steps because they've got an addiction that is life-threatening. I wish I could give a better answer, but I don't think there's one answer.
Thank you. Can you describe your relationship with your higher power and how it has evolved over the years?
Well, it has not evolved. I've never believed in a deity. I grew up in a family. I'm a third-generation agnostical atheist or atheistical agnostic, and it's never bothered me. My relationship has only deepened in the sense that I feel more and more comfortable that acting intuitively according to my deepest values will do the best for me and will ultimately have the best possible outcome, even though the outcome may not be what I want. And now my deepest values are truth and love, justice, to which I give a very specific meaning for me, a moral kind of morality, and beauty. And if I live according to being the most truthful kind of person I can be without harming others, a just and upright person living for the truth and looking for the truth, and a person who exudes as much love as he can, I think that's the best I can do in this world. And I've become more and more convinced of that over the years, so I'm more and more tied to that. I guess that that is the extent to which my relationship has changed. It's deepened. You know, I can afford in the midst of sadness to experience beauty and not feel guilty or ashamed of experiencing beauty. I can afford to make mistakes, bad mistakes, and I have made some bad mistakes, knowing that my motives were good, that I did my best to be truthful, loving, just, experience whatever beautiful means in that context. And I say, well, I tried my best, and I don't feel guilty from having made that mistake. So I say, I'll learn from that. So over the years, that's been my relationship. I hope that helps.
Thank you. What age did you become a compulsive overeater? I think you said you had began in childhood.
Oh, childhood. There's a picture of me. There, it's an old movie of me when I was thin, when I was 4 or 5. But my recollection of myself has always been as a fat kid, always eating.
And somebody was just, you were doing big book study workshops. Are you still doing them now?
Well, I'm not traveling these days, so I'm doing them by Zoom. I'm still a little leery of large gatherings, large public gatherings. But if people want me to do any Zoom things, I'm always available to do big book studies.
Well, I think this is probably a good place to end. So thank you to everyone.
Thank you.
To attend this webinar, thank you to Lori and for all those doing service.